This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, on International Women's Day, many women in North Carolina and around the world are taking the day off. The strike is called A Day Without a Woman, and the purpose is to draw attention to the paid and unpaid labor women do every day. The organizers behind the historic Women's March on Washington earlier this year are behind this mass protest. They're calling on women to stay home from work or not to shop or to wear red in solidarity or to find some way to show solidarity with this day and this movement. Chapel Hill Carrboro Schools is one of a handful of districts nationwide that closed in response to the strike. Joining me in the studio to talk about A Day Without a Woman is Jocelyn Alcott. She's a professor of history and gender, sexuality, and feminist studies at Duke University. Jocelyn, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Also joining us is Nashonda Cook, a fifth grade teacher at Eno Valley Elementary School in Durham, who is participating in the strike. And I should point out the Durham schools continue to hold classes today, and we are lucky enough to have Nashonda Cook here with us. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here as well.
And I should say welcome back. We've had you on the show before. Tell us about, because I know you spoke at a rally, at a gathering in Durham earlier today. Organized by the group Action NC. What was your message to that crowd?
My message today was the solidarity of women and the effect that it can have. History has proven that when a group of people are together and we take care of one another throughout the organization part and the actual action and afterwards, that change does come. So I asked my fellow educators who were there and our parents and teachers to stay strong, support each other, understand that everything that you're fighting for, educators are fighting for as well. You know, we are the ones who also need help with paid family medical leave. And we are also the ones who are affected with senseless gun violence. And, you know, we're also the ones that need to be able to pay our bills monthly. So everything I feel comes back around to education. So, you know, my message to them was I'm inspired. I'm hoping that I'm inspiring you, and let's stay encouraged and let's continue this.
You just named a couple of specific goals for you in particular. What are some of the other goals? Why are you participating in this?
Well, you know, it's part of my DNA, honestly. My family, my mother and my grandmother participated in protests and strikes and marches in Selma and Montgomery, Alabama, when things were not being adequately, you know, and honestly displayed for the nation to see. A lot of times in education, you hear things like, oh, we want to reduce class size, but they're not telling the whole story. They want to reduce class sizes on the backs of other teachers. And if they do reduce the class size and not provide funding for it, we have to let go of some of our coworkers. And we have done more than enough of that, more than enough of that. So, you know, there are things that we have to make sure that the general public population knows that what's really going on.
Well, this business of balancing these priorities on the backs of teachers, the people on the front lines, I think is important and maybe illustrated by school systems that urge teachers to come to work in part because the school system offers other things, other services, particularly to poor children, for instance, and meals and that sort of thing. But again, it sort of places the blame on the teacher for not providing adequately for our students in need.
Yes, you've got it absolutely correct. It's an accurate analogy. It's a double-edged sword. You know, we take care of our own children and then everyone else's children when we come to school. And we're trying to prepare them for the future, for their immediate future and for the future that they have outside of education. And for their families, we are raising intelligent beings, creative, curious beings, but also we want to raise advocates. We want to raise the children to understand that if you feel wrong, there's a respectful way to respond to it. And then to also advocate for yourself and support yourself and stand by your brother and stand by your sister. So today was a perfect example of that. You know, we talked to our students and we said, yes, this is what you're going to see. We talk about this in class. In fifth grade, we talk about the American Revolution and all the protests and the boycotts. We talk about the Civil War and how there were two different sides that saw the future going a certain way and they didn't agree on it. So today we were able to give them a current event and have a personal experience with the same thing going on.
Well, you've also named various kinds of protests. There's mm-hmm. violent protest in the
yes.
form of a civil war. There is protest and in the form of carrying signs and
yes.
demonstrating. This is a strike. This is non-participation. And you talked about your grandparents
yeah.
who participated in the Montgomery bus boycott, which is prototypical, at least in this country,
yeah.
in terms of how non-participation with evil was quite successful in that particular movement.
And I'm hoping to, you know, stand on the shoulders of my ancestors and do the exact same thing, make sure that I'm a part of a successful movement. And I appreciate my educators who are still at school and kind of holding the fort down. And some of them are wearing red. Others are going to make sure that they're not shopping at certain places unless it's a women's business. We are all participating in several different ways. I was lucky enough to be able to take today off. I'm paying for it out of, you know, what my options, but I had a very encouraging and supportive administration, and they appreciated that I came to them. So I was very lucky to do that. Not everybody had a chance to do that. So I'm happily advocating for those who didn't have that opportunity.
Jocelyn Alcott at Duke University, let's take one step back a little bit and talk about the larger goals as you see them of this particular day of protest.
Yeah, I think what's interesting, so as probably most of your listeners know, today is International Women's Day, which used to be called International Working Women's Day, right? And the emphasis today is to highlight all of the labor that women do. So paid labor, unpaid labor, caring laborers, you know, all kinds of, I mean, everything that women do to make this world work. And the idea of withdrawing that labor is to highlight what happens. And we, you know, as you said, if you do that over the Montgomery bus boycott, you see it over, you know, that impact in the long term. What happens if you do that for a day hopefully draws attention to what it would mean, you know, how undervalued that labor is.
So that's an event that, again, as you say, can draw attention for a day. What about sustained efforts and the efforts and movements that you have studied by mm-hmm. women mm-hmm. to sustain a protest over time to achieve certain goals? Tell us about some of your research.
So there's, I mean, and I would say there's been a lot of anxiety today about, as you said, this sense that the burden of some of this might be falling on some of the poor women and children of in poorer families. I would make a distinction between what's happening today, which draws on its own legacy, which is a work stoppage. It's a one-day effort. You can see some antecedents to this in the 1970 Women's Strike for Equality, the big march in Washington. In the United States, obviously, the day without immigrants has been a big precedent. The similarity in some of the movements that I study, in last October, there was a series of women's work stoppages in Argentina and Mexico, throughout Latin America, actually with some sympathy movements in places like Spain about violence. So really starting from the issue of violence against women, the precipitating factors were some particularly spectacular episodes of violence. But these movements, just like the ones that Nishanda was just talking about, always also reach out to other things. So all of those movements, you know, they may start from a precipitating moment, much like today's. I think the precipitating moment was the election of Donald Trump and all that seemed to stand for. But it has reached across to a lot of different movements.
So obviously it has the attention of a lot of people, in fact, all around the world. What about the effectiveness of movements like that and this particular strategy, non-participation,
right,
withholding your work? How effective have they been in recent history?
So it depends. You know, the upside, if you will, of having it be a one-day movement is that it's contained. And I think it puts less of a burden on families and on coworkers and all of this. On the other side, if you really want to have leverage, it needs to be open-ended, right? The Bureau of Labor Statistics will say work stoppage is a generic term that includes a strike. But I would say that what distinguishes a strike, a real strike, is you're demanding concessions. You're saying we are not going back to work until this demand is met. And the leaders of this movement have decided not to do that. To be honest, I think that's a really smart move. And the reason I think it's a smart move is the organizing simply isn't there yet. What it takes to pull off a strike, and anybody who's studied strikes knows this, is a lot of really hard, on-the-ground, face-to-face organizing. It's not going to happen over Twitter. It's not going to happen over Facebook. It's going to be happening because you sit down, I think in the way that Nishanda is talking about with other teachers, you sit down with the people you work with and with your neighbors, and you really build relationships of trust and confidence that can endure through what will be some very, very difficult times. So this one-day effort is not going to be as efficacious, as you say, as something that could be more sustained. But I don't think that's what this particular action is trying to accomplish.
And Nishanda, what do you think, too, about the open-ended quality of this, the fact that women were asked to participate in any way possible? Withholding their labor was one, but if that wasn't possible or feasible, all other modes were acceptable.
I agree. I think that's a very smart strategy to go about it, because a lot of women are not able to take the day off, but they can choose their wardrobe for the day. You know, they can hold conversations for the day. They can decide, well, you know, I'm not going to shop here today. I'm going to go here instead. So I think the sting is still there. I think folks will see what the possibility of this could be if we don't do something about this now. Imagine what would happen if this was long term. And it's great that we are giving people various ways to participate.
I want to continue this conversation in a moment. I'm talking with Jocelyn Olcott, who's a professor of history and gender, sexuality, and feminist studies at Duke University, and Nishanda Cook, a teacher at Eno Valley Elementary School in Durham, who's participating in the strike today. We'll continue that conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today is International Women's Day, and many women in North Carolina and around the world are marking this day by participating in a mass strike. It is called A Day Without a Woman. Right now we're talking with Jocelyn Olcott, a professor of history and gender, sexuality, and feminist studies at Duke University, and Nishanda Cook, who is a fifth grade teacher at Eno Valley Elementary School in Durham. She is participating in the strike. Jocelyn, we're talking about the effectiveness of these movements and strikes and other kinds of actions, but this also gets into what has been a kind of an issue and a conversation around feminism for decades now, and that is the mode of organizing, to what extent it becomes a kind of top-down issue and just participation in the current economy, and whether or not this is talking about changing a system, and if that's true, then the mode of resistance is going to have to look different than the current, you know, sort of top-down kind of patriarchy that's given us a country and an economy that we have right now.
Yeah, I think that, you know, women's activism more generally, and feminism in particular, has for a long time, certainly since the 1970s, been about changing the system, as you say. And I think that one of the things that this movement is trying to do is to remain really quite elastic in terms of how it organizes, what the approaches are. So I'm sure many of your listeners know that after the Women's March was so successful on the 21st of January, that they called for 10 actions in 100 days. And they've been releasing these actions. So this is one of those actions. But the actions have all been oriented toward keeping the demands really open. So Nishanda mentioned that gun violence might be important to her, or, you know, school choice, school opportunities, teaching possibilities might be important to her, class size might be important. And to me, it might be healthcare availability or reproductive freedom, you know. So we all have our issues. So they started out with this thing that's I studied the 1970s, so this spoke to my, you know, 1970s feminist heart. They started out with a postcard campaign, right? Like, what could be more 70s than a postcard campaign? And it was smart because you could make up these postcards yourself. It had the logo on the front, so it communicates this is part of one big action, and said, get together a bunch of your friends and write a postcard about whatever is important to you. Just let them know their slogan is hear our voice. Let them hear your voice. And it's been incredibly effective. And they moved from that to, and I should say, I went to get a group of people together for a postcard party, and someone put on Facebook and like 600 people signed up to come to this. We had to decenter it. But and their next move was to have these huddles, which, to be honest, sound like 1970s conscious raising sessions, right? These get a bunch of your friends together and just talk about what's important to you, talk about what the possibilities are. So this is very different from a kind of old school approach, and even, you know, a labor union approach, which is very, very effective, but tends to be, here's our program, let's execute it. It's saying, let's let the whole movement come from the bottom up. And I think it's in part that the leaders of this project learned, you know, they had this kind of misstep right out of the gate with it being organized by people with not a lot of experience, and it wasn't a very diverse group. And they were criticized for that. And their response was, okay, let's change the movement. Let's invite more people in. Let's change the message. Let's change the approach. And it's really, you know, we'll see what this delivers. But I think inviting in that instability, uncertainty is actually the strength of the movement.
Now, Shonda, how do you see it going forward, though? Because obviously it is the strength in the sense that it becomes more broad-based and more inclusive. But then the question of sort of how do you achieve any of the particular goals? And I wonder what your sense is moving forward, being a part of this movement, whether you are optimistic about whether they can coalesce around particulars to bring change.
I absolutely believe that these are some very effective steps to bring change. I think it's been a very inspiring and encouraging moment. I think more women like myself are choosing to run for office. I'm starting off with a local teacher association. Others, we had an announcement today about a young lady who's going to run for office for one of the seats. So it's very encouraging because as women, we don't just sit back and accept things. You know, we... My mom used to say that the man is the head of the household, but the woman is the neck. The neck determines which way the head is going to turn. So I think that's exactly what we're getting ready to see here. More women are learning to stand up and speak out for themselves and for their sisters. So, you know, as long as we have that and we're supporting each other and we have the support of our husbands and our brothers as well, it's going to be effective. It's going to be change. And as history has shown us, it may take a while, but it will happen.
What do you hope your students are going to take away from this?
I hope they know that, you know, when Ms. Cook talks to them in class about change, that there is a proper way of doing it. There are several different ways. You have your choice. You know, you can speak out. You can write a letter. You can protest. There are several different ways. But I also want them to learn how to be advocates, self-advocates. And I want to show them a very effective strategy that we use in the classroom is modeling. So, you know, I can get up and I can write the notes on the board or I can show them a movie. But I can also say, last week when Ms. Cook stood up and she spoke about making sure your family stays safe and you feel good about the education you're getting, that's what I want you to get out of this.
So you're not being in class today may be the most effective thing you've ever done in front of your students.
For some of them, I think so. We'll see what happens when I get back.
I want to thank you both. And Shonda Cook is a teacher at Eno Valley Elementary School in Durham. She's participating in the strike today. Jocelyn Olcott is a professor of history and gender and sexuality and feminist studies at Duke University. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.